Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. As I may conceivably have mentioned, I am in the closing stages of my new book.
I think you're the first person ever to have written a book, and certainly the only person involved with this podcast ever to write a book, judging by the way you talk about it.
I know, but I mean, I explained how I had 6 months lopped off my deadline. So it has been very, very brutal. But
people
are weeping
to hear this, even as you speak.
But I am closing in. I had a very productive weekend. So I reckon I've got about maybe 2,000 words to go.
2,000 words? That's like a morning's work.
2,000 words to go, and then maybe 3,000 word introduction. So okay, next week or so,
should be done. So you'll be done tomorrow.
But, I had a very productive weekend because I was writing about one of the most haunting and intriguing episodes from ancient history, which is the death of the Emperor Hadrian's beloved Antinous, who drowned.
Yes, I know you're very enthusiastic about this. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the about what it involves?
Death on the Nile. Okay. So it's just down from the city of Akhenaten, which Agatha Christie, of course, actually wrote a novel about Akhenaten, but she never wrote about this. But I think it's an incredible whodunit, because the basic facts are that Antinous is about 18 or 19. He's the favorite, the beloved.
He's the sort of companion, isn't he,
of Hadrian? Companion of Hadrian. So this is a kind of Greek relationship with the elder man and the adolescent lover, beloved. And Antinous is, 18 or 19. He's starting to probably sprout a bit of hair. Right. And, this is not so good. So he's possibly emotionally in a state. Hadrian's in a state because all kinds of problems are kind of looming in on him. He's with his wife. They're going on a cruise up the Nile. And then Antinous is found drowned. And the scale of Hadrian's grief is absolutely titanic. He founds a city called Antinopolis on the next to the stretch of the Nile where Antinous drowned. He proclaims Antinous a god. And the cult of Antinous as a god kind of takes off an explosive degree. The question is, how and why did Antinous drown? Hadrian says it was an accident. Other sources say that Antinous was sacrificed to give Hadrian a longer life. Whether this was done by Hadrian or whether Antinous willingly committed suicide, accepted to be drowned. Adding to the complication is the fact that he seems to have died in exactly the same way, in exactly the same river, and at exactly the same time as the god Osiris was supposed to have drowned.
So it could be some sort of sacrifice or ritual that went out of hand, or
who knows? Further theories might be that he was murdered, perhaps by Hadrian's wife, perhaps by a kind of rival courtier. Perhaps Hadrian killed him in a kind of fit of rage. Hadrian was very prone to fits of rage. Perhaps Antinous faked his own death, got fed up.
Like John Stonehouse.
A bit like John Stonehouse, only to less glamorous and enduring effect. Anyway, it's a great, great story. And I just wish that, Agatha Christie had written about it.
I know you love channeling your inner Hercule Poirot. Do you give a Poirot style?
I don't.
Do you give us your answer?
No,
in the book?
We can't know the answer.
Oh, Tom, so disappointing.
The sources that we cannot know the answer.
Fine. But for the purposes of this bonus podcast, where's your money?
For the purposes of this podcast,
you must choose one and only one.
I think that Antinous probably willingly, I think he was, well, we're straying into the dimensions of historical novel here.
Come on.
But I could imagine a scenario in which Antinous is worried about the contempt and, because there's no contempt and scorn for him as a concubine of Hadrian as an adolescent, as a boy or adolescent. That's fine. That's fair game.
But as a grown man, it's a problem.
As a grown man, it's a different matter, and he's on the verge of adulthood. So I think you could imagine that he might be looking for a way out, and the scale of Hadrian's response of his grief and of his evident gratitude, sense of gratitude to Antinous, perhaps suggests that Antinous willingly offered himself up to become a kind of new Osiris.
Wow.
So I could
dark,
kind of imagine that. It is. Yeah, well, of course, there are, you know, there are echoes in this story of the Christian story as well, which is why the church fathers detested detested everything to do with Antinous. You know, the idea of because Hadrian is a kind of father figure, Antinous is kind of, you know, a son. He takes on the sins.
He's the Holy Ghost in this scenario.
Who knows? Well, I suppose the breath that brings him back to life, because Hadrian has a vision of him in which he returns to life.
Wasn't there an exhibition at the British Museum about 15 years ago about Hadrian and Antinous?
It wasn't just Antinous. It was Hadrian generally. So it had, you know, Hadrian's Wall and his war against the Jews and all that kind of stuff and the Pantheon. But it was very good. Anyway, so, but that's enough. That's what I've been doing. What have you been doing? Do you have a good weekend?
What was I doing? I actually can't remember. I can't really remember what I was doing. I was reading a book, Tom, about tourism, about the history of tourism.
And what do you think?
Because we're gearing up for an episode, well, for two episodes about holidays. And it's a book by Lucy Lethbridge. It's about, I mean, I don't need to tell you, but I'll tell the listeners. It's about sort of the invention of mass tourism, isn't it? So it's about the period after the Grand Tour. So the Grand Tour, the great 18th century kind of ritual for aristocrats and sort of poshos to go off and inspect ruins in Rome and interfere with the local ladies and carry off bits of masonry. So this is about the next, Lucy Lethbridge's book is sort of, I don't know, 1815 to 1945, really. There's a sort of final coda all about Mallorca in the 50s and 60s. But it is absolutely brilliant. It's fascinating, isn't it, Tom?
It is brilliant, isn't it? I was waiting to see whether you'd enjoyed it. I thought it was wonderful and so rich in detail and so amusing.
Very amusing. So
simultaneously compassionate and amusing.
We shouldn't anticipate podcasts about this, but the stuff about spa towns and about the health cures. Have you read all that? The terrible water that people were drinking and the sort of crazy diets.
She made the point, which I had never thought, that, of course, the word obesity has replaced corpulence. And I suddenly, corpulent is a great word. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, it has. It has. She also has a brilliant thing. She says the word that sums up tourism in the second half of the 20th century is inclusive. If there's one word that is all inclusive, so the obsession with inclusivity in terms of cost and the sort of penny pinching attitude of British tourists. So people are absolutely determined to make sure that their food is included in their hotel bill.
Yes.
But also just ludicrous sort of, there's a brilliant bit where they're talking about how guidebooks are telling people that when they go to Italy, they should treat the local religion with respect rather than basically turning up and just trying to educate the locals. And there's a bit where they say at one point in the first half of the 19th century, somebody went to look at St. Peter's and they discovered that mass was in full swing, but some British tourists had arrived and set up the camp behind a pillar having a picnic with loads of champagne and hampers and things. Yeah. I mean, the sort of display of absolutely ostentatious disrespect.
I thought that the single kind of funniest and most shocking bit was the advert that Thomas Cook ran for the Côte d'Azur in 1915. Very...
Oh, yeah, in 1915.
Very uncrowded due to, to world events.
But the extraordinary thing is that people, that was an eye-opener to me, that people were still going on holiday to France during the First World War and saying it's great, it's very unspoiled now, it's very quiet, it's out of season. Anyway, Tom, we're doing that podcast now, which we shouldn't be doing because we're going to do it. Well, after we've done this bonus, we're going to discuss how we're going to construct our holiday podcasts. Because I think, do you still want to talk about the Romans?
I do. And actually, having talked about Hadrian earlier on, he was a great tourist. And definitely, it's slightly different. The Romans didn't have a word for holiday. But I think you can make a case that, I mean, we'll do it as a kind of coda, an addendum to the main feast.
Well, what was Julius Caesar doing when he went off on his barge with Cleopatra down the Nile? I mean, there's an element of tourism in that, isn't there? He's sort of looking out at the pyramids and...
Yeah, completely. So,
yeah. All right, let's move on to some of the things that people have sent in. So Ethelfrith on Discord, I assume. In order to celebrate Yorkshire Day, Ethelfrith sent in a picture of Constantine the Great. Well, I say sent in a picture, I mean... presumably copied and pasted a picture from the internet rather than this was some family heirloom, a photograph. Arguably one of the most influential people in history, he was proclaimed emperor while he was in York. And this is the picture of the statue outside York Cathedral. And so Ethelfrith says, therefore, is Yorkshire the most historically significant British county? And is York the most historically significant English city? Of course, it's very unlike people from Yorkshire to proclaim the virtues of their own county, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, it's a rare display of Yorkshire immodesty here. Most unusual. So,
Constantine the Great, is he the most important person to be associated with York? Probably is.
I suppose he probably is, yeah. Have you seen the statue of him?
I have indeed. It's outside York Minster, isn't it?
Yeah, massive man spreader. He's wearing quite a kind of skimpy skirt, and he's honestly...
Right.
Legs. You've never seen knees so far apart.
Well, just on Roman statues, before we get back to Yorkshire, I saw a photograph in the newspaper. I might have seen it online, of a statue in Braga in Portugal of the Emperor Augustus. Oh. Have you seen this? And it's coloured. It's painted.
Oh, yes,
it's
yes.
done as a...
Yes.
And I thought, what an interesting and what a cool way to have a kind of Roman statue, to actually do it as the Romans presumably would have done it. And so his breastplate is all kind of beautifully, gorgeously colourful and all this sort of thing. And he's got brown hair rather than kind of, you know, marble white hair. And presumably that would have been true of the statue of Constantine, that his statue would have been quite bright, wouldn't it?
Well, the one outside York Minster is a modern one.
The original models.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, let's get back to York. And
to York.
Is he the most... Who else went? Eric Bloodaxe is associated with York.
Constantine, definitely.
Richard III. But Constantine is a massive figure, isn't he? Maybe the founder of Fries or Roundtree's or something like that. Chocolates. But I think we're struggling at this, aren't we?
But is Yorkshire the most historically significant British county? I suppose in a way, because historically it was the largest, wasn't it?
It was.
So, I mean, it was more of almost a kind of mini country, really, relative to other counties.
Well, Dan Jackson, at this point, a Northumbrian specialist, would be saying you're mixing up Yorkshire and Northumbria, wouldn't he? He'd say, you know, he's all about Northumbria, and he would say it was the kingdom of Northumbria, wasn't it? Basically, when Eric Bloodaxe was running it.
Yeah, it was part of it. But, I mean, if we're talking counties as they've historically existed, I would say...
The most important English county, Tom, is Shropshire, the cradle of the Industrial Revolution.
Shropshire.
Cradle of the Industrial Revolution.
I think you'll find that actually the most historically significant county is the one with the oldest and most impressive prehistoric monuments.
No, you'd say that, but, I mean, if they didn't exist, human life would be utterly unchanged, whereas no Shropshire, no Industrial Revolution... Tom would be living like dogs, and the planet would be in much better condition. But
exactly. So Shropshire is to blame for this endless hot weather we're having. Well, you take the credit. I suppose you'd have to say probably Middlesex, wouldn't
what?
You? Well, because it's where London is. So London is obviously...
Yeah, but I don't rate London. I don't like London, and I don't rate it. So
I know you don't like London, but London is clearly the most significant.
It's not more important than Ironbridge. Are you making seriously made that claim on this podcast?
Oh, go on with you. Let's move on to Mark My Words, who asks, who has been the more influential writer, Tolkien or his pal and co-conspirator, C.S. Lewis? We've done a lot on Tolkien, but nothing on Lewis. Can they be compared, or does Lewis pale in comparison?
You think we've done a lot on Tolkien? Wait till we get to the autumn.
Yeah. I think Tolkien has been by far the most influential as a writer, as a novelist. Because his model of fantasy has been hugely more influential than Lewis's, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. I don't think Lewis really has a model of fantasy, does he? It's such a great... I mean, even Tolkien himself said of Lewis's fantasy, how is Father Christmas in a world with with fauns in it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he kind of mixes, Greek and Norse and Father Christmas and everything, all kind of mixed in. Quality Street Box. But I'm not qualified to opine on this, but I'm sure there are listeners who would be. I'm guessing that Lewis is very influential as a theologian and as a Christian apologist, but I think much less influential as a novelist.
I think, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is enormously popular. I mean, lots of children will know of it. The film was very successful. And that device, I mean, Tolkien's device of the ring is obviously hugely influential, and even people who've never read The Lord of the Rings and laugh at orcs and elves know what the ring is. You know, it's kind of such a symbol, isn't it, of power and evil and stuff. But also Lewis's device of the wardrobe, of going through the wardrobe. It's funny, I was only talking to Arthur, had a friend over to play, and we were talking about, I don't know, books or something. And they both said that in their own home, they had gone into the wardrobe and, you know, tapped at the back of the wardrobe to see if they could get. And I remember doing that when I was a child. And I think there are probably millions of people worldwide who have done that. I think I think the idea of the wardrobe is the gateway to another world is actually the single most abiding. I mean, everybody knows that, don't they?
Yeah, I suppose. What Tolkien does is to create the idea of a fantastical world that is self-contained and has a kind of inherent plausibility. And he does it, you know, in such a detailed scale because he has the knowledge to do that. Most other people have failed to achieve that degree of richness, but it's always been the aspiration. In a way, the kind of the greatest works that I think Lewis has inspired have been Philip Pullman's fantasy series, which was a kind of reaction to it.
Yeah, because he hates Lewis.
Well, he does hate. Well, he says that, but clearly, it's a bit like the relationship between Westeros and Middle Earth. That Westeros is written in reaction to Middle Earth, but would be inconceivable without it, and in a way, therefore, is a homage to it. And I think that to a degree, Pullman's novels are absolutely a homage to,
of course,
to Lewis's.
I agree with you completely, Tom. I also think with Tolkien, you walk into any branch of Waterstones, the major British book chain, and you go to the section fantasy. I mean, basically every book in that section is Tolkienian, isn't it? They've all got dwarves, they've all got dragons, they've all got axes, they're all set in a medieval world, aren't they? I think Tolkien is, I mean, there's an argument, isn't there? Tom Shippey makes this argument that Tolkien is the single most influential writer of the 20th century. I mean, irrespective of what you think of his quality, the fact that he inspired so many imitators, not just in literature, but in video games and films and music.
He invented a genre, and not many writers who invent a genre.
No, even you haven't done that, Tom. Although the new book, of course, who knows?
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. So we are recording this on Monday morning, and the episodes on Justinian and Theodora have just gone out. But they've been out in Australia, obviously, for a bit longer, or at least people have been able to, you know, up and about and able
they've
to
been
listen
awake.
To them. And we had an absolutely lovely message from Bruce Baxter, who is a taxi driver in Sydney, who says that he was listening to the first Theodora episode and a guy hailed him. And when he got in, he asked Bruce to pause what he was listening to, as he was also a fan and wanted to listen to the episode when he got home without any spoilers. I think that's as lovely a message as we've.
Wow. I never thought we would have spoilers on our. yes. The people would be. They don't want to know what happens next.
Well, the absolute cliffhanger that we left the first episode on.
That's right. I thought that. I really enjoyed doing that series. So we had a very, very busy week last week, didn't we? Because we did the episode on Justinian and Theodora that actually took 3 hours because we did three episodes. And then we did the episode on China's war with Japan with Rana Mitter, which turned into 2 hours. In fact, more than 2 hours, because Rana had to interrupt it to go and do something else.
No, he had to go on RTE, so the Irish news program.
Yeah, and then come back and finish the...
and the question he was being asked was, are we about to enter World War III? And he reassured us that we probably weren't yet.
Yeah. And then finally, we did our one episode, which I thought was probably going to be about 35 minutes, about Lady Jane Grey. And that turned into two episodes as well. We had a very busy week. I don't know why we're whittering about our... Oh, because Justinian and Theodora. I loved doing that, I have to say. I thought... I hope listeners enjoy that, because I think it was really good fun to record. Really interesting subject. And somebody... So Capel Loft has already weighed in on Twitter, Tom.
Yeah, he's very keen to have to make more theology.
Yeah, hopes we're going to stamp on Theodora as the Monophysite heretic that she was. And of course, we only scratched the surface of Byzantine heresies in that episode.
Did.
So you were remarkably reluctant to discuss the difference between Chalcedonian, Monophysites, Miaphysites, and Monothelitists.
I'm cowed. I'm so used to you berating me for introducing.
You just don't know what to do, do you? You just don't know what to do.
No.
I wrote a whole essay about 6th century. After a good 2 days work in 1994. So I consider myself a complete expert on it now.
I think a 6-part series on Christological controversies in late antiquity be very exciting.
I'd like to do. One of the great historical, is it an essay? I think it's an essay written in our lifetime. Peter Brown's thing about the holy man in late antiquity. Mm-hmm. So about these fellows who stood on pillars.
Stylites.
Simeon Stylites.
Yeah.
All these sort of characters. They are a weird bunch and a great story.
So one of my favourite things about the Stylites, you know, these guys, hermits who sit on pillars, is that the emperors in Constantinople, and we touched on this in the beginning of the first episode, but the emperors were so desperate to make Constantinople the kind of the great center of Christianity, despite the fact that it had no pedigree. You know, this wasn't Jerusalem or Alexandria or Antioch, still less Rome. That not only did they go around nicking relics from all the other churches, but they also imported stylites.
Oh yeah, they did, didn't they? They used to try and persuade them to come and...
We offer you excellent terms. Please come down your pillar. We'll provide a much better pillar in Constantinople.
I mourn. I mean, we've got that fourth plinth, Tom, in Trafalgar Square.
Oh, we so have.
Wouldn't you love to see Philip Pullman on the fourth plinth? Or A.C. Grayling? Or somebody of that ilk?
Yeah, I suppose. A humanist stylite.
Professor Alice Roberts. Great fan of yours. I think the reaction from the London mob would be less obliging.
Well, do you remember who was that magician who stayed in a box, a perspex box?
Oh, yes, yes.
I can't remember what his name was.
Is it David Blaine?
David Blaine. Yes, he stayed in a perspex box, and the London mob, howled at him.
They threw things at him, didn't they? Made you proud to be British.
Someone really felt more proud to be British. But someone, you know, I think a stylite who was prepared to get in the long haul, kind of 20, 30 years, would be a tremendous attraction for the capital.
So the closest we came, there was a man who lived on the grassy reservation in the Wolverhampton Ring Road, Tom.
Did he?
A homeless man for about 20 years or something. Uh-huh. He had a little hut or something like that, and he lived in this... Yeah, he was a hermit, basically. I don't know anything else about him, so I can't really...
Did he become a tourist attraction? And I asked that because I thought one of the more startling passages in Lucy Lethbridge's book, which we must stop going on about because we've got to save this, but was how you know, people would go and look at funerals or paupers or whatever.
That's right,
and that kind of human suffering became something that plump Victorians would go and have a gawp at.
People still do that, Tom. I mean, she has a thing in her book about the invention of the idea of the authentic local experience, doesn't she? So in other words, people would go to Italy and they would see people making pasta in an old-fashioned way, even though actually in reality, people no longer make pasta like that in Italy. Yeah. And people still, they do things like they go on favela tours in Rio.
Yeah,
I mean, they're very popular. You go and you sort of tour the shanty towns, the crime-ridden shanty towns, and you can come back and you say, oh, it was much more authentic than being on the beach.
So she's very interested on the whole thing about authenticity and how important it is. Anyway, listen, we mustn't do that. James Marriott, Times columnist and podcast critic, who I have to say is very, very, very much a friend of the show.
I was going to say, as friends of the show go, I mean, he's not so much a friend of the show.
He's the friendest.
I mean, he's close to being a lover of the show, if that's a category. The antinous of the show, Tom.
Steady on. But James gave us our first review, didn't he? Just after we'd started, maybe 3 or 4 weeks after we'd started. So we're always incredibly grateful to him. And he's very, very kindly in his notebook, which came out in the Times this morning. So that's Monday morning. He's given a name check to the episode we did with Carl Harper on Plague and the Fall of the Roman Empire. And he, in cheery form, customary cheery form, because it has to be said that his columns they haven't been the cheeriest.
They're very Larkinian, aren't they, if that's a word.
He wrote a fabulous essay on Larkin on Saturday.
He did.
I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah.
Really yeah. great. Written with such kind of love. I thought it was a wonderful essay. Anyway, he's saying it makes you wonder about all our ideas of progress. Do the conventional measures, railway cities, impressive buildings, mean anything at all? Because so this is following up on Carl's point that the heyday of the empire was very unhealthy for people.
Yeah.
Because it brought pathogens into the heart of the cities and things. I suppose one of the measures of certainly 19th and 20th century progress, and we talked about this with Carl in the previous episodes we did with him, is that progress in the fight against disease has been absolute.
Yeah.
And we lead lives that are healthy beyond the comprehension of previous generations. And that's why COVID came as such a shock.
Although, don't these things contain the seeds of their own? Because don't Perhaps. We create all these superbugs in hospitals that are resistant to antibiotics and stuff? So we may be living in the sort of sweet spot, but generations hence may face much deadlier things than we're facing. I don't know. I think it's a fair point.
Well, and of course also, you know, all the planes, all the burning, you know, due to Iron Bridge, all the fossil fuels and yeah. things may end up destroying us anyway. So maybe. I mean, maybe.
Damned if we do, damned if we don't.
Maybe you always have to pay a tax on progress.
I think you said, you obviously do. I mean, that's a great theme of history, isn't it? The tax you pay on progress. I think, I thought Kyle's argument about people being smaller was absolutely fascinating. This idea, because we're so conditioned to see the arrival of cities as equaling progress and therefore happiness, that actually the idea that all these people in the cities are just crippled by chronic diarrhea, well, and living surrounded by enormous piles of human waste.
Shit. And not just human waste. I mean, and Carl's comment in his most recent book, you know, the history, I can't remember what it's called, but the history, entire history of disease, where he says that humans are the only species that positively choose to live surrounded by their own shit, has yes. stayed with me.
You love that fact. I've heard you mentioned it more than once.
Yeah. Well,
have you fixed, Tom, let me ask you, say on that question, have you fixed the toilet seats in your bathroom?
No, not yet.
So Jack, our producer, went to install equipment, didn't he, in our respective studies about 9 months ago, 12 months ago?
Yeah.
And I said to him, report to me about whether Tom Holland has fixed his toilet seat.
I haven't because got I time, Dominic. I've got to do my book.
I think that has been, his toilet seat has been broken for about 5 years.
No, we did. So we did actually repair that one, but it's broken again. So it's broken, but it's broken in a different way. It's broken in a different way.
Has put up a message saying, what's wrong with it? Explain. I mean, as I recall, there wasn't even one there.
The seat that you know, the bit that you sit on had come loose. So you sit on it and it slides off. And now it's not completely loose, but it kind of, it pinches. I don't want to go into the details, but I will fix it. I will fix it when I finish my book.
Do.
I can't
multitask. So basically, if there's any listeners who are plumbers in Brixton.
It's not plumbers.
This is your chance.
It's not plumbers. It's a malevolent toilet.
It's not even plumbing.
That breaks.
It's like a very basic handyman job.
It's cursed. It has a curse on it.
Oh, dear. So, Tom, I punished you with that, which was unfair of me. So I shall reward you. I shall make it up to you. But the question about Christianity. Doreen Wilson says, I was reminded of Rodney Stark's work suggesting Christianity disproportionately grew during these plagues. He cites evidence that the Christian families stayed in the cities and cared for the sick, which gave them a higher chance of surviving. By the time the plague subsided, the Roman Empire was much more Christian. I find all this fascinating, and Tom should love this. So is there a direct link between plague and the rise of Christianity?
So Rodney Stark's a sociologist who has looked extensively at what kind of trends can be distinguished around the growth of Christianity in the Roman Empire. And obviously it's very difficult because there aren't the kind of statistics that a sociologist can normally play with. And he's fixing on the fact that there is a definite growth in the number of Christians over the course of the 3rd century AD. But it's not like there are hard and fast figures that you can play with.
Yeah.
But the thesis, but his thesis is that, so he's talking specifically about the Cyprian's plague. So Cyprian is a bishop in Carthage. And Cyprian's plague is the one that people who've listened to the episode with Carl may remember. It's the one that may conceivably be a kind of pneumonic Ebola, which is just hideous because there's this description of kind of blood coming out of the eyes and the nose. So really, I mean, really horrible. And it seems that this plague raged for maybe 10 or 20 years. So very, very violent in its effects. And Cyprian, as bishop, gives sermons in which he urges Christians to stay in cities and care for the sick, and not just for their own, but for everyone. And Stark's thesis is that by doing this, they maintained kind of support networks that other people didn't have, and that these support networks therefore basically enabled Christians to survive more readily than non-Christians. And I'm not qualified to opine on whether that's the case or not, but certainly seems plausible.
But you can see how the plague would encourage the growth of, as it were, non-canonical, sort of slightly outside of religions that had an apocalyptic element, or a sort of more esoteric element. So Christianity might be one, or some of the other Eastern religions that thrive in this time.
I think indisputably what Christianity provides, and as we know, having gone through COVID, this is something you really want in a plague, is a kind of welfare state. And that is something that was very, very distinctive to Christianity.
Right.
No other cult really provided that. And the measure of that is that in the fourth century, the great enemy of Christianity, Julian the Apostate, fixes on that, the fact that the impious Galileans, as he calls them, that they furnish welfare not just to Christians themselves, but to everyone, as a kind of key aspect of Christianity's appeal. And it's why Julian then tries to kind of reconstruct the old gods, the worship of the old gods, as a kind of welfare state, which it obviously wasn't. So you can, you know, it's in time of disease that you want that kind of support. And in the third century, people were suddenly discovering that that was possible. Nobody had thought that such a thing might be possible before that. So I think that the roots of the kind of support for the sick that we had during COVID do lie in that kind of proto-welfare state that the church was constructing in the third century. I'd go that far.
Yet another thing, it turns out, is deeply Christian, Tom.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you want to read know more about this, you can, of course, buy Tom's book.
Thank you, Dominic.
There you are. So then when you've got the sales from Dominion, you'll be able to hire that handyman, Tom. That's the key thing.
Yeah, I will. So Arthur Brown.
You must be delighted by this.
He's written about pigeons.
Yes.
And he says, Dominic, do you want to know what Arthur Brown says? I'll tell you what Arthur Brown says. Arthur Brown says,
God, tell me,
that despite the skepticism that some people involved with this podcast may have displayed towards the idea of doing an episode on pigeons, that it was possibly one of the best, Dominic, one of the best to come from the podcast. It was extraordinarily interesting. And I would say that that's very much been the tone of response to it, that people...
Are you sure Arthur Brown really exists and he's not just you?
No, Arthur Brown definitely exists, because there have been a lot of people saying, what a brilliant idea this was. Congratulations, whoever came up with this idea. And boo, if either one of you didn't want to do it, fire.
Well, no, I really wanted to do it, Tom. That's a lie. That's actually fake news. That's complete fake news. You know perfectly well that whenever you say to me, Dominic, I've got a great new guest, I'm very excited about it, then my reaction is always unbridled enthusiasm.
Yes. Yeah, I suggested one only this morning, and the harumphing from rural Oxfordshire.
It would actually, I think now you're so used to it, you'd be disappointed if I didn't do it, wouldn't you?
Anyway, Arthur Brown has this to say. He says he found it even more interesting as his great-grandfather, William Proctor Smith, had a pigeon that was used in the Second World War. William of Orange, the name of the pigeon, great name, was awarded the 21st Dickens Medal for its role in saving 2,000 lives in the 1944 Battle of Arnhem when he flew 250 miles back to his nest. So I wonder if Al Murray knows that, because Al is very interested in the Battle of Arnhem.
He is. Anyway, listen, William of Orange went on to be the father of many excellent racing pigeons. So that's first-class news. I don't know how to rate
that. Great on William of Orange.
News. Yeah. Let's move on to ravens. I don't want to talk about Lord Moylan because I think he's a madman. Let's talk about...
Who is ravens. Lord Moylan?
He's a...
I don't know who Lord Moylan is.
He is a peer. I think he's a Tory peer. I might be wrong. But he's one of these people who sort of says,
so this is the story that Tom McTague brought up about,
yes,
Brexit messing up pigeons.
Lord Moylan is a kind of, it's all the fault of the EU man. That's his stock trade, I think. He's not merely a Brexiteer, Tom. I think he's an ultra Brexiteer.
Okay.
He's such a Brexiteer that he would regard somebody like me as a weak, lily-livered, left-footed, metropolitan weakling. And what he would think of you, not principal.
Okay. So well, let's leave him. Let's park him on one side. So Simon Girdleston, talking about ravens, not pigeons. I understand the Vikings used to use ravens to help them navigate. If they were out of sight of land, they would release a raven that would fly upward and from height have a better vantage point to see land. If it did, it would fly towards the land and the Vikings would sail in that direction. If it didn't, then it would fly back to the ship, which chimes rather well with the raven finding the land story. So that's,
I was going to say there's a very famous story about this because there was a man called Raven Flocky who supposedly was the first Norseman to deliberately, sort of intentionally sail to Iceland. So there are sort of three different versions of the discovery of Iceland. And Flocky, so there's a fictionalized version of him in the series Vikings. He did exactly that. He released a raven. And the only trouble with that is all of those stories are written after there are other Greek and sort of Roman stories of people releasing birds. So sometimes people
and
say, well,
biblical.
Yeah, biblical. So people say the Icelandic sagas are probably just tosh, using formulas that they've read in the Bible and stuff. So actually all this releasing ravens may not be quite as entrenched.
Well,
but anyway, Tom, what are you going to say?
But on that subject, well, I was going to say that, of course, we have the great Neil Price coming on very soon to talk about Norse gods.
Yeah.
Weird shit.
Gods, myths.
Horse penises.
Religion.
All that kind of stuff.
So yeah, great. You love all that, Tom.
Well, honestly, once you've read his chapter on Odin worship and horse penises, very difficult not to go on about it, to be honest. And that's why I'm glad this podcast exists.
Well, that gives you an opportunity to sound off about things that Sadie bans you from talking about.
Well, because otherwise I'd have to go off and kind of berate tell strangers about it because it's so interesting. But now I can do a podcast.
You can tell me.
Yeah, I can tell you. So that is definitely something to look forward to. And what have we got coming up? We're going to do holidays next week. I think we should put holidays out next week, actually.
Do you?
Because it's... Yeah, I do, because it's the middle of August. And otherwise...
Well, let's not make any promises, Tom. I mean, we're live on the...
All right.
Well, we're not live, but we've got a lot... We're recording an awful lot in the next few weeks because we're recording special episodes about Portugal, the history of France in film, Tolkien, Great Fire, Young Churchill, Japan. We've never done any Japanese history.
Yeah.
Walt Disney, Ramsay MacDonald, Marilyn Monroe. And we've got a lot going on. That's a lot of reading.
It's a lot of reading. Thank God I'll be finished my book soon. All right. Well, I think that's enough. Thanks very much for listening. Hope you're enjoying Justinian Theodora. And we'll be back very soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.